More fifthist SCPs. There are a lot of anomalous groups of interest in the SCP universe. It makes sense that there would be tons of differing opinions on particular anomalies and anomalies in general. But while some groups of interest are pretty clear-cut in what they think and how they operate, others aren't so simple. Fifthism, or the Fifth Church, is a rather mysterious organization by and large. They're mostly known for SCP-1425, a book titled Star Signals that allows readers to warp reality to suit their desires. It was spread through various advertisements and talk show interviews, creating quite a problem for the Foundation. The problem is that the Fifth Church really has no central structure, no core tenets, and no telling of where or how they're going to show up next. They're obviously connected very much with the number 5, as well as an extra-dimensional entity, SCP-3125, that could pretty easily wipe out all life on Earth. I've done a video on them in the past looking at a general overview of the group, but now we'll check out a handful of SCPs connected to them to various degrees. Let's take a look. Let's start with SCP-5800, a hypothetical alternate reality that is known in relativistic physics as the fifth dimension. We're informed at the start that this article has been locked by the Foundation Preservation Guild for a couple of reasons. They originally found it on a vinyl disc in the ruins of Site-01, and when they inserted a copy of it in the old Foundation database, it was automatically erased. They've also decided to lock all of the pages on the SCP Wiki due to the attention it has been receiving in order to prevent vandalism. This will be more relevant in a bit. Specifics of this fifth dimension are unclear due to the inability of Foundation technology to properly analyze mathematical and anomalous dimensional constructs higher than our own, but it does retain radically different ideals than the laws of physics of baseline reality. It is host to living, inconceivable abstract concepts that operate in noospheric subspace similar to that of biotic components interacting with one another in a natural ecosystem. Most of these abstract concepts or entities are predatory in nature and aggressively envelop or dominate weaker ideatic concepts in order to increase in fractal topology. 5800-1 is an aperture located approximately 5.5 astronomical units away from the Earth, appearing as a uniform 5 polytope. This aperture does not conform to normative space-time, and instead appears to possess a tessellated geometry that steadily increases in complexity to the point that Foundation supercomputers are incapable of processing a digital representation of it. That's a lot of technical jargon, but basically it's a dimension populated by abstract concepts that operate in the noosphere, the realm of human thought. They roam the noosphere and consume weaker concepts in order to increase in fractal topology, a familiar term from our favorite cosmic starfish, SCP-3125, the god of the fifthis. There's a window into this dimension out in space, but it's too complex for even Foundation supercomputers to map out. Outside of being the fifth dimension, the Foundation knows it's related to the fifthis, following several events involving SCP-1425, 2155, 3005, and 4565. Following a more accurate quantification of 5800, Foundation resources are to be devoted to its neutralization. We're then told about Igor Petroslav, a Russian sorcerer during the 1700s who was one of the first to codify their practices into what is now known as thaumaturgy. Towards the end of his life, he discovered 5800 and began to perform experiments on it. Following his death, his next of kin hid his work on it in a hidden chamber in his stronghold, which wasn't rediscovered until it was excavated in 1996. We're provided some relevant paragraphs from his research, which read, "If there is a world of ideas, then there is a world that contains the opposite of ideas. It took some experimentation to be able to breach the boundary between these two worlds, but now I can see why it was sealed away. I found it to be frayed at the ends, yet overflowing with some substance that can only be accurately described as light in our universe. This light is very pleasing to take in. Unfortunately, it melts the mind and causes madness. Abram stared into the portal for the entire day, and at the end he couldn't say a coherent sentence that didn't involve the color pink or the sight of smoke. In addition, the light seems to have an adverse effect on animals, as my two cats ran for their lives at the sight of the opening. If my observations are correct, I believe that submerging anything inside of this world will inevitably result in the idea remaining there. Victor put an apple inside of the portal before taking it out. The apple slowly shifted forms and color until it turned itself into a green snake who spoke cautionary tales about liquid hands and hateful stars in the sky. I took the liberty of sealing the aperture after that. I'd rather not have ideas interact with that world for a prolonged period of time. We're then given a transcript of an audio recording from Dr. McWarren, one of the lead researchers analyzing 5800's effects on human cognition. He states that he's been bleeding out his nose and ears for the past 2 days, and it keeps messing up his papers. What they've learned so far about 5800 is that it's an ecological ideascape for extremely volatile, abstract concepts. These things have a hierarchy of sorts, which is dictated by the size of these beings. He uses the term size loosely, because these things are presented in sets of infinites. They are defined as uncountable infinities, despite logic telling us that there can't be anything larger in scale than infinity. These beings are represented by their Aleph numbers, numbers which represent the cardinality of infinite sets. Professor Hutchinson stated that such beings exist in these numbers and have been known for quite some time. What they've found out is that there is a philosophy stemming around the hidden potential of the human mind. In order to ascend past the boundaries of everything, one must secede from their personal principles and unlock what's within. It's just a metaphorical analogy, ideas presented in a way for us to understand how to truly be one with the very hand that exists above us and sits at a many-angled throne of stars and pure radiance. He pauses at this point for 30 seconds, before sharply inhaling and exhaling. He apologizes for getting carried away, and says that there are sects that have had a long history with a certain key stretching all the way back to the Third Crusade. A key that could open all the doors to the world and the mind itself. They haven't figured much about this door, though. He's sure they have some keys locked up that can open some doors, or all doors, but he doesn't know anything about a door. As far as he's concerned, he doesn't think they ever had a door contained in the first place, but he's not sure. He doesn't expect anyone to understand. He thinks this thing is affecting him and his research partner somehow, and they're telling them to go on a medical leave. Their research and data on 5800 is getting pushed to someone named Harkness, who has more experience with this than he does anyways. We're then told that the portal to this fifth dimension appeared after some testing between two SCPs, so the Foundation made this thing themselves. Of course, now that they have a portal to a fifth dimension, the Foundation has to send something through to check it out. A Uralina-class colony was set up near the entrance, and a director was selected to head exploration efforts, but O5-5 decided to oversee exploration themselves, citing a need to be precise. A robotic drone was to be deployed on April 9th, 2095, but 5 days prior to deployment, Site-19 Command received a transmission from the colony. The agent aboard the colony states that they're being pulled into the aperture, despite Site-19 replying that, from their telescopes, it doesn't look like the colony is being pulled at all. The agent replies that there's a light, and they're being pulled into it. Site-19 asks if they should send an evacuation team, but the agent says that they're drifting away, and he doesn't think they'd fare. the transmission then suddenly ends. Despite what he said, an evacuation team was mobilized, but before evacuation could occur, the colony suddenly vanished from reality. The only known survivors were O5-5 and several of his associates, who had escaped from the colony in a custom escape pod. We're then given another file that was found on the same vinyl as SCP-5800, with a notice stating that, given the fall of the Foundation occurred shortly after the events described above, it's believed to be relevant. It contains an extended description of SCP-5800, which states that 5800-A refers to the concept of the Foundation as an entity. After an event on May 5th, 2095, 5800-A has been partially submerged inside of SCP-5800. This has caused an alteration of the Foundation's core mission statement, the replacement of several high-ranking officers with members of the Fifth Church, the release of many SCP artifacts and entities due to new protocols, and the absorption of several minor groups of interest, such as the Global Occult Coalition. The event in question involved the director of MTF Alpha 1 entering the O5 Council's main chamber as part of a surprise inspection. They found O5-5 performing a ritual involving the sacrifice of several important Foundation personnel and the drawing of a star on the floor using chalk. Alpha 1 managed to interrupt this ritual but suffered major casualties. In response to the changes enacted to the Foundation, parts of the Foundation broke off with the goal of overthrowing the O5 Council. We're given an interview between Dr. Sean Remus and O5-5. In which he asks the O5 if he's heard of the Chaos Insurgency. The Overseers had become tyrants, and the insurgency was formed because they did not want to see the world ruled by people with power left unchecked. He thinks that they're trying to imitate them, and asks why he suddenly changed the Foundation's prime directive and absorbed the competition. O5-5 replies that he doesn't really get it, as they can't just solve the world's problems by putting them all in boxes. Four-sided boxes, filled with the vilest and the darkest of evils. Remus replies that if this is about the number 5, there's no scientific evidence that it is what he claims it is. O5-5 ignores him and says that God will cleanse this fetid world. This forsaken universe is a sin, and they will be born anew in God's glorious, dazzling light. It's not a fantasy. It's not even a reality. It is so much more than that and beyond. It's an escape, and they have the key to bring it here. Remus asks if he's talking about SCP-5800, but the O5 just asks him what happens when you cut the arm off a starfish. Remus replies that it grows back, and the O5 says that God's omnipresence expands above all the worlds in every universe. They thought they could keep it out by obliterating the very idea of God's existence, and it didn't even work. They tried to excise it from the very abyss in their heads, but like a starfish, it grew back. You can't stop it. God is here to bring them what they deserve. Remus just replies, with all due respect, that he's insane. Five ignores him and says that they thought they could just lock the door and throw away the key, but it was always there. They put God on the other side of the door and pretended that everything was all right, even though it wasn't. It never was. But they can still try to bring it here. He tells Remus that deep down in the moist music and the orgasmic smoke of his heart's mind, he knows that it's true. They already have the key, and they know what the door is. All he has to do is let them in. He tells Remus to call his men off and tell them to let them in. The recording is then suddenly cut off, presumably from Site-01 becoming a set of ruins. So, the Foundation opened a portal to the fifth dimension, where SCP-3125 originates from, alongside an infinite number of infinite entities like it, and it bled into our reality, corrupting the heads of the SCP Foundation, leading to its downfall. Presumably, that aperture is still out there in space, probably growing bigger, along with the entities inside of it. A real fifthis dream. Next, let's look at SCP-3511, a female human of Latin American descent whose anomalous property causes any living organism from the kingdom Animalia to be repelled when coming within 7 centimeters of her. She came to the attention of the Foundation when radio scanners detected a conversation on a small radio show produced out of Oakland, Wisconsin. On the show, Jim and Carrie fix strangers' problems. They get a call from a teacher who has a girl in her class who started acting fairly difficult lately. It was normal, rebellious teenager things, until the last day of school when kids were packing up to go home. The girl, Erica, got up and stood in the doorframe. Kids tried to leave, but they just couldn't get past her. They literally couldn't touch her. They'd get close and then they'd just stop. People got antsy and started fighting. Students in the hall gathered around to see what was going on. The teacher asked her to move, but she looked at her and said, "Notice me. I want to be here. I want to be seen. I want to be touched. So no, you move me." The hosts admit that that's pretty strange, and the teacher admits that they don't quite remember if it was that dramatic or not. They talk to the girl's parents, but they just seemed confused, and the teacher felt bad about it because they were quite pleasant. One of the hosts says that there might be something weird happening at home, but the other host says that his solution is to get a therapist on the case before hanging up on the caller. An agent was dispatched to perform interviews with the locals, but while some acknowledged her to be abnormal, none believed it to be anomalous. We are given one interview with a high school student named Tyler. Tyler says that he's known Erica since he was 6, as they went to elementary school together. They definitely weren't close, though, as he wasn't the nicest of kids, and they got into playground fights a lot. They went their separate ways after elementary school, as apparently her parents demanded she change schools. He says that they were pretty protective of her. About 10 years later, she spotted him in a park and came over. He was hanging out with his friends, and he barely recognized her, but she started yelling at him, saying that he made her like this. He has no idea what she was referring to, but she kept walking, and he felt himself backing up toward the river, like something was pushing him that way. Luckily, she stopped before he fell into the water. He just looked up at her with his back foot over the edge of the riverbed, and it took a solid 5 seconds before he could muster an apology. She turned around and left. After this interview, Erica was detained through the use of remote-controlled drones, and all civilian observers were administered Class C amnestics. Her parents were also administered amnestics and told that their daughter had been killed in a car crash. Gotta love the Foundation. On the second day of containment, it was deemed appropriate that Erica should have access to an on-site therapist, Dr. Wei. During their first interview, Erica doesn't say anything, before acknowledging that she'll be locked in here probably forever. Wei asks her about her parents, as they barely spoke of her during their interviews. She says that they were crazy, completely insane. Home wasn't comfortable. It didn't even feel safe. They called her their little starfish, but not in a cute way. It always sounded deranged. They'd say things like, "We must protect the starfish," or "Our little starfish is our little light fish," and "Guide us to the end." She doesn't know what they meant, but it felt wrong. During a later session, Wei brings up her parents again, and she says that they only called her their starfish in private. In public, they referred to her as the minor. They were cold towards her, and whenever anyone talked about her, her mom would generally say that she's just a child. It made her feel unimportant, like she wasn't worth being around. Maybe it's why other people ignored her too, like her teachers. Whenever she brought up an issue, they'd wave her off and tell her to talk to someone else. Sometimes she had to get in their faces about it, and she'd be called difficult. During her fifth month of containment, footage showed strange behavior from Erica, in which she would sleep on her left side, causing her arm to lose circulation. Upon waking, she would manipulate that arm in various ways. I'm not going to make a joke here. Due to concerns for her emotional state, another interview was conducted. Wei tells her that they're worried about possible nerve damage and what it implies about her emotional state. Erica replies that she's done this since she was little, after she started being like this. Usually after her parents ignore her for a long time. Sometimes it's hard to distinguish between your own body and someone else's. If you cut off circulation to your left hand, then you can pretend like it belongs to a stranger and hold it with your right hand. If your whole arm goes numb, then you can put it around yourself and it feels like a pat on the back. They gave her a physical here by using robots, and it all felt so cold. It's been 6 years since she last touched someone, because Tyler cracked her head open one day, so she came home with a bloody bandage wrapped around her head. Her parents freaked out and dragged her to the basement. She doesn't remember what they did to her down there, but all she remembers is her mom saying something like, "Just until our starfish grows up." It rings in her head. Wei tells her that he'll contact his superiors to see if they can give her more opportunities to socialize, and he'll ask if there is a less mechanized way they can conduct her physicals. Wei's suggestions were incorporated into her schedule following this interview, and an attempt was made to detain her parents for possible connections to anomalous organizations, but they were not found at their residence. Their recovery is still underway. After 13 months of containment, Erica's eating patterns underwent a steady change, with her consuming smaller portions of her meals until stopping altogether. An emergency therapy session was held, in which Erica asks Wei if she's supposed to just whittle away her life here. She always knew she wasn't getting out of here, but she overheard someone talking about charity work, some fundraiser for holiday food baskets. She realized that she's not doing anything. She's just here, and she's barely here at that. She can't even tap someone on the shoulder. They might notice her, but they won't feel her. Wei replies that a lot of people go through these kinds of thoughts, that the world would be no different without them. Erica asks if they're locked up, only seeing the light of day twice a week on escorted walks. She's just a drain on the budget, an hour and a half of his week. She wants to feel again. She wants to feel accomplished, a part of something. But if she's just destined to go numb, then she wants to be euthanized. Wei tells her that they're not going to do that, because she's definitely worth more. If she wants an opportunity to make an impact on the world, they'll see what they can do. He'll ask his superiors to come up with a program. All she needs to do is ask. In the meantime, since they don't want her emotional state to worsen, he asks if there's anything else they can do to help. Erica just replies that a hug would be nice. Various options were proposed for how to accommodate Wei's suggestion, but none were approved before Erica's neutralization. On her 18th birthday, she woke up and scratched her shoulder with a confused look on her face. She pulled her shirt back to reveal a small bug bite, stating aloud that she got bit. She then rushed to the door to her containment cell, exclaiming for them to tell the doctors that she's normal again. A security guard approaches and she begs for his hand, but they state that they can't let her out, so she yells for them to call Dr. Wei. 30 minutes later, Wei arrives and the guards open the door. Before the guards have time to respond, Erica hugs him and begins to cry. He says that he guesses this means that they'll have their last session then, and returns the hug. Following the event, she underwent additional testing before being deemed neutralized. She was administered amnestics and returned to Greensdale, Ohio, with a reasonable cover story. So it seems her parents were some crazy fifthists that believed her to be some sort of offspring of the cosmic starfish or some other unknown aspect of fifthist lore. When she got injured as a kid, they used thaumaturgy to make her anomalous, preventing anyone or any creature from touching her until she turned 18. All in all, at least it was a happy ending, except for her ending up in Ohio. Let's move on to SCP-2858, a set of generic PVC soap pump bottles, with their only distinguishing feature being the label on the front of the bottle and the composition of the soap. They do not appear to have any real-world source, despite their labeling, and civilians who receive them report them being delivered by an anonymous sender. Foundation tracking of the packages reveal that they are inevitably sent from one of many Foundation front companies, despite no records of such deliveries existing. The Department of Meta-Analysis has determined that the frequency of their appearance is directly proportional to the local population of wasps, the percentage of the population below the poverty line, and the number of prison inmates from the area with sentences over 20 years. The bottles are invariably labeled with the words Neutrogena Wasp Cleanser and state that they are produced by the non-existent Stanford Caldwell Party Limited. They provide a list of component chemicals that are always incorrect, usually featuring implausible or simply fictitious compounds. While such labels usually appear similar to the labels of other contemporaneous Neutrogena products, the company has never manufactured a product named Wasp Cleanser. When questioned, representatives stated that they had no intention to produce such a product anytime in the foreseeable future. The contents of the bottles share few common features between them, aside from the fact that they are invariably light blue in color. We're given a short list of a few of the bottles, the identified components of which range from water and acetic acid to milk and salt. Subjects who used bottle number 18 reported minor redness and skin irritation, while the substance that comes out of number 23 behaves like a highly adhesive and stretchable solid. The substance from number 27 causes an aerated solution of blood plasma and DDT to erupt from all pores that make contact with it. This has been shown to continue for up to 3 hours, with one D-class reporting it to be a refreshing experience, despite showing symptoms of severe hypovolemia. Upon application of the substance from number 31, pores that made contact with it expanded to approximately 13 times their previous size. Several tooth-like structures began to develop, which were able to grind an inserted steel needle into fine powder. The pores then sporadically contracted and expanded for 7 hours before the dissolution of the tooth-like structures, during which time the subject's body returned to normal. On March 25th, 2014, a commercial advertising SCP-2858 was broadcast on multiple popular television channels in the US from 4 a.m. to 4:11 a.m. When questioned, employees of the broadcast station reported no memory of the advertisement ever being aired. Due to the low visibility nature of the incident, disinformation protocols were successfully put into place, and the commercial passed off as a one-off horror special. We're provided a transcript of the commercial. It begins with a close shot of a woman's face, with a text overlay giving her the name of Cynthia Durham. It zooms out to show her sitting on a stool and wearing a white lab coat. She states that here at Neutrogena, they know when wasp infestation strikes, you need to fight back fast. So when they break out of your body, you need to make sure they stay out. She then produces a bottle of wasp cleanser from a table beside her and shows the label to the camera. Notably, her arms are covered in multiple red welts. The commercial cuts to 3 instances of the wasp cleanser, with one being a pump bottle, one being a small tub of cream, and one spray bottle. Durham states that they recognize that wasps don't just go away overnight, so they developed a 3-step solution to the problem. The first step is the lotion, specially designed to counteract the infestation fast. The scene then changes to a view of another woman in an orange jumpsuit. She has multiple red abscesses on her face and is applying the wasp cleanser to the affected area, As the scene progresses, the abscesses become noticeably larger and more swollen. The abscesses then burst to reveal multiple wasp larvae, which the woman then picks out and flicks away. The scene then cuts back to Durham, sitting on the stool, now holding a small tub of cream. She states that the next step is the trademark topical cream. No matter how deep the wasps get into your system, she guarantees that Neutrogena's patented cream can get them out. The scene cuts back to the other woman, now applying the cream to the rest of her body. It's noted that it's currently believed for the cream to have similar effects to bottle number 27, as evidenced by the emission of large quantities of unidentifiable fluid. The fluid contains small foreign objects, presumed to be wasp nymphs. The camera cuts back to Durham, holding the spray bottle. She says that because you don't want any pesky wasp fragments sticking around in your body, they developed the perfect way to get them out with a formula, all new and improved with the aid of their helpful test subjects. The scene changes to show the unidentified woman inhaling the contents of the bottle. After coughing heavily, the woman then begins to exhale significant quantities of smoke, before then exuding smoke from her eyes, ears, and nostrils. Durham says that it doesn't just get rid of any loose bits of wasp, but also makes sure they stay out. The woman slowly ceases emitting smoke and shakes her head vigorously, dislodging multiple small black particles assumed to be fragments of wasp body. She then sweeps them off her face and turns to smile at the camera, before the scene cuts back to Durham, who calls for some celebrity testimony. A clip is shown of a man identified as popular musician Beck. His face is similarly abscessed, and the welts appear to have spread to his hands and wrists. Notably, he appears to be wearing a green star pendant, typically associated with members of the Fifth Church. Beck thanks the Neutrogena wasp cleanser treatment for getting rid of his wasp infection within the first week of beginning treatment. He'd been trying for weeks to find an anti-vespid cream that worked fast and was hypoallergenic, so when they came to him and offered the chance to try out the product, he sprang for it immediately. A before and after image of Beck is shown, with the before picture showing an abscess hosting a developing wasp midway through the process of it breaking out, as well as multiple small, boil-like growths on his neck and cheek. Said growths have mostly disappeared in the after image, instead being replaced by red blotches of skin. Beck gives the camera a thumbs up and says that no other product works better, and to remember that because wasps die in 3 easy treatments, the world endorses this in 5s. Following the conclusion of this advertisement, civilians who had received bottles prior to containment received gift vouchers for non-existent Neutrogena products, ostensibly also aimed at treatment of wasp-related conditions. Notably, said vouchers thanked the recipients for their efforts in solving the shortage, although what this shortage was remains unclear. Hey, say what you will about the Fifthis, at least they're putting out a product to help people with a pretty serious problem. Wasps in your body are more likely than you think. Next, we have SCP-6775, a loosely defined political philosophy which comes under a number of names, most often consisting either solely of the letter E or using a name which centers around said letter. It appears to be focused on the notion of singularism, the precise meaning of which is inconsistent, but most often consists of the voluntary focusing of resources and labor into a single point within society. Generally, this singular point is one which would not provide a great deal of benefit if focused on to the exclusion of all else, such as niche luxury industries or the personal advancement of a seemingly random segment of the population. Outside of this primary goal, other components of 6775 are most often infeasible, contradictory, or outright nonsensical, and appear to change often, whether over years or over the course of a single conversation. Despite the Foundation's efforts in erasing all traces of 6775, new groups espousing this philosophy, known as 6775-1 instances, continue to independently arise around the world. Interpretations of the philosophy vary among instances, but they will consistently attempt to run for public office whenever the opportunity arises. During this time, individuals outside of the instance will react to the philosophy in a manner that suggests anomalous alteration of their perceptions. While individuals will by no means automatically agree with and subscribe to the philosophy, they will consider it with a level of seriousness that the coherence of the philosophy would not warrant. As such, in cases where the 6775-1 is especially charismatic, they have come dangerously close to actually achieving victory in these elections. The first known instance was Jean J. Laurent, who ran for president of France in 1974 under the group name of E. They ran based off of a promise to focus the wealth of the nation solely on the critical development of the city of Paris. Numerous other minor policies were promised as well, including a selfishness tax to be placed on French citizens, which would increase by 10% for each interpersonal relationship that citizen had. The demolition of the Eiffel Tower, purportedly so that the attention of the public would instead be focused on the French school system. And the public execution of the previous French president, despite the fact that he had died in office. The original E group is believed to have been founded primarily as a cult of personality around Laurent, who was openly engaged in sexual relationships with many other members. Few records of him exist prior to the formation of E, but those that have been found suggest he was a Parisian pianist of little renown. Following his loss in the election, he is believed to have left the country and has not been seen since. All other members of the party died from various unrelated causes over the next 2 years. In 1989, a group in Chicago ran their leader Harry Norton for mayor. The group was called the Chicago Convergence for the Cause of Enacting E, a deliberate misspelling of Chicago that the group used persistently. They ran on the promise of discouraging moral decay and sexual heft among the people of Chicago, though the means by which they would do this were never detailed. When questioned regarding these measures, they would instead detail entirely unrelated policies, including the dismantling and decommissioning of the Chicago sewer systems, so that labor could instead be focused on the construction of a one-to-one replica of New York's Chrysler Building. When asked by an interviewer how the issue of waste would be handled following this, Mr. Norton angrily accused them of being a communist and ended the interview. They also ran on the posthumous pardoning of crime boss Al Capone, whom Mr. Norton insisted had never done a tax evasion in his life, and the privatization of the Chicago Sun-Times, as it had been running for over 10 years and was therefore the only publication of value in the city. All other newspapers would be outlawed. The group was by far the least successful recorded instance of 6775-1, as even though people did not find their policies necessarily strange, the outspoken and vitriolic demeanor of the group's leader alienated much of the voter base. 2 days following the election, Harry Norton was reported missing by his wife. A week later, police found his severed head, torso, right leg, left leg, and genitalia scattered throughout the basement of the Chicago Town Hall. All other members of the group went missing immediately afterwards and have not been seen since. In 2012, the Necessity of E Party ran for the governor of Saga Prefecture in Japan. As they ran solely via their website and various online advertisements, the only information available regarding their policies is what was specifically posted there, with no further questioning possible. Their policies consisted of the enactment of a designated human law, under which households would be asked to choose a designated human from within their family. All wages, workplace benefits, and scholarships from within the household would thereafter treat the designated human as their beneficiary. They also ran on demolishing the Tokyo Tower, despite not being located in Saga Prefecture, and no reason was provided for this, as well as outlawing twin pregnancies within Saga Prefecture, citing the selfishness of the extra child as their reasoning. Despite their unusual campaign strategy and lack of engagement with the voter base, the necessity of E-Party came dangerously close to actually winning the election, a result only prevented by the active efforts of Foundation agents and web crawlers. Following their loss, the necessity of E-Party posted an audio file on their website, consisting of 52 minutes and 8 seconds of continual hysterical weeping. The website went down exactly 5 minutes later. In 2019, in the UK, the E-Enactment Party ran for a Member of Parliament for Bath. The majority of their policies were based around building policies and housing within Bath, often being restrictive in nature. These included a strict ban on having more than 6 rooms in a single household, with the leader, Edgar Carlisle, voicing his intention to reduce the allowed number of rooms by 1 for each year he was in office. They also ran on a 75% tax raise on all supplies relating to the construction of windows, and a public bounty posted on all selfish doors. The party was one of the more concerning instances to date, gaining a large amount of interest before Mr. Carlisle was successfully assassinated and replaced. This has been attributed to the instance's willingness to engage with the media, unlike many of their predecessors. As an example of this, we're provided a segment of an interview between Maria Lane, a journalist, and Carlisle. Lane says that there has been a lot of curiosity and interest in E recently, but also a lot of caution, and she asks him if he's ever held public office before. Carlisle replies that prior to this election, he was employed as a butcher. Lane remarks that that's quite a big change, and she imagines a lot of people are concerned he wouldn't have the sort of experience needed for that role. Carlisle shakes his head, however, and says that they're actually very similar occupations. In both jobs, you're focused on cutting away the fat. You're needing to get rid of things you don't need so you can focus on the things you do need, the things that will benefit you. And he thinks his proposal to demolish Big Ben perfectly illustrates that, because people are focused on things like that rather than the things that do matter. He's no conspiracy theorist. He's not going to sit here and rant about the New World Order or the Illuminati. But all he's saying is that Pepsi controls 13% of the British coal industry. A footnote tells us that this is not, in fact, true. He just thinks someone needs to figure out what's happening there, because a lot of people are rightly concerned. Lane replies that that's a concern shared by many people, and she's sure they appreciate him focusing on it. Carlisle laughs and says that he's focusing on everything right now, as that's what it means to have priorities. On July 11th, 2020, it came to the Foundation's attention that John Bellarmine, the founder of Green Springs, an unrecognized micronation in South Dakota, had updated their official website to announce numerous upcoming changes to the micronation's laws, taking place on July 19th. These consisted of changing the micronation's name to E. Castle, the enforcement of communal living, with all citizens required to reside in the same house, although he hoped that they would all reside within the same room, given time to acclimate, a total ban on reproduction, and a total ban on all travel in or out of the country. Due to the small size of Green Springs and the relative ease of containment, it was decided that the Foundation would allow these new laws to be enacted in order to observe the results of a 6775-1 instance actually achieving office. A team of researchers and agents were dispatched to Green Springs in order to observe said results. The only known survivor of the expedition, Dr. Robert Twine, was found uninjured and wandering the area immediately outside of the micronation 2 hours following loss of contact. After being brought in to Foundation custody, he produced the following written account via vomiting it up. "I'm not fully sure how to describe my experiences. This was a very disorienting experience, you understand. The feeling of wrongness began when we pulled up to the premises. I'd read the files, and I understood that the micronation consisted of 3 households and their families, but where I was looking, I could only see one house. It was hardly an ordinary house either, a mishmash of different architectural styles. It was as if someone had taken the whole place apart and stitched it back together. Even the air was like that. As soon as one of us got out of the car, he started to be sick, a soldier boy, because it was so bad. We went into the house to investigate. Everyone was silent at first. This was a very disorienting experience, you understand. Nobody knew what to expect. After we got through the first two kitchens, it became obvious that this was no ordinary homestead. The main attraction was in the living room, spinning like a disco ball up near the ceiling. I was told there were 12 people living here, and that checked out 100%. I could see them crushed up all together in a sphere floating in the air, like how rocks clumped together to form our Earth, all squashed and compressed-like. They were cracking insistently as we watched and commented. 13 had become one, just like that. I think there were only 3 of us left at this point. After my partner was finished, I turned to the remaining member of our team and indicated he should pick up the phone. He told me much the same, and I had to agree and apologize for my selfishness. This was a very disorienting experience, you understand. I answered the phone. The caller was a distinguished sort. Some vowels elongated, some slurred, just like that. I told him as much. "Hello?" I said. "Hello? Hello? Hello? Hello?" I looked down at the phone when it said that, and this was a very disorienting experience, you understand. I realized that it was my own skin I was speaking into. This was quite a shock for me, and when I said it to the phone, I said as much. This sort of selflessness wasn't something I was used to happening. I had to admit as such. But I was glad my skin could be good for something, and I said as much, and I listened closely to the reply, which took for me a shock. This was a very disorienting experience, you understand. But I was glad everyone was finally coming together. Everyone was finally coming together. And then I woke up at home. They've got my vote. The area surrounding Green Springs has been completely quarantined following this incident, but it prompted considerable concern among researchers that the philosophy had the possibility of arising even in incumbent officials, therefore eliminating the need for 6775-1 to achieve electoral victory at all. In an effort to understand the psychology of 6775-1 instances, in order to forecast such developments, an extensive search was conducted for relevant materials. An unused segment of the interview between Carlisle and Lane was discovered, in which Lane asks what the E means. Carlisle shifts uncomfortably in his seat and says that he's always been interested in numerology, as it's a very inspiring notion that everything they do is governed by forces outside of their control. It's an idea that offers a lot of freedom, and that's something he really relates to, even though it doesn't really apply to him. Even saying that, he pleasures himself privately quite a bit, and it's a similar sense of abandon. That's what he'd say E is all about, that kind of community spirit. Lane thanks him for the opportunity to get inside of his mind in this way, and Carlisle laughs, saying that he's sure he'll be seeing everyone inside there again, come election day. It goes perhaps without saying that, of course, E is the fifth letter of the alphabet. Seems like the fifthists have been trying to worm their way into public office for some time, with their usual flair for the nonsensical and grotesque body horror. Let's end with SCP-6655, a highly contagious, info-hazardous concept discovered by memetics researcher Morgan Riley on March 10th, 2017. It's noted that information regarding it is to be restricted to Site-55, which has undergone noospheric quarantine and placed under lockdown until further notice. While the specifics are still under active research, it is extremely antithetical to conventional human thought. were then provided an archived testing log, starting with a D-class introduced to SCP-6655 infected media and quarantined under standard information sensor practices. Within 6 hours, his communications became a vector for 6655, and after 24 hours, his behavior showed major deviations from his known personality. These include decreased empathy, increased proclivity for violent acts, negligible attempts at self-preservation, and incomprehensibility. After 48 hours, he was sedated and the test was terminated. Later, he was amnesticized to determine a possible countermeasure to infection, but conventional targeted amnestics failed to purge the symptoms. General amnestics, capable of removing all memories, also resulted in failure. After extensive testing, a mixture of Class D amnestics, Class X amnestics, chlorpromazine, and lithium salts was successful in purging infection from him, although long-term side effects include severe photophobia, difficulty forming new memories, confusion, and insomnia make this impractical as a treatment. Researcher Morgan Riley, the project lead, was also infected inadvertently during the first test, and she attempted to self-medicate with a mixture of high-grade amnestics, nestics, and mood-stabilizing lithium salts. The experiment resulted in failure. The fourth test log is skipped, and the fifth test involved Morgan introducing SCP-6655 to researcher Martha Smith for research purposes. The results are listed as irrelevant. A large number of extraneous tests are omitted, with the next two both listed as test log 5. They both involve Morgan introducing two other senior researchers to 6655, with the results listed as irrelevant. A triple-digit number of other extraneous tests are omitted, with another test involving Morgan introducing 6655 to the site director. Following the dissolution of the memetics department and the recontainment of 6655 by the Foundation 5th Department, the above information has been deemed irrelevant. Another test log 5 shows a D-class being treated with the mixture, causing an immediate state of panic. The subject vomited and objects to test 5, citing large piles of viscera inside the test chamber and coating the room's walls. The visceral buildup is noted to be far below that required to impede test 5, and as such, testing continues. Approximately 33 hours later, testing concludes due to lack of viable subject. Appropriate decontamination measures undertaken. Another test involves giving the mixture to researcher Morgan Riley to sever her connection to 6655. She displays severe distress at her surroundings for an unknown reason, proceeding to vomit excessively before fainting. Research assistants administer stimulants to resuscitate her as she enters a state of severe panic. No further legible information could be gathered, and the test was terminated. She was returned to Foundation employment following re-enlightenment. The next test, listed as Test Log 1, has the subject listed as Morgan Riley, self, exploring the long-term suffering potential of the mixture via a daily application of the remedy. She writes that she can barely even look at sunlight anymore. Memories come and go, and she cannot comprehensively put a mental timeline together. Several notable events are entirely missing. Whether this is due to trauma or the mixture is unknown. She cannot sleep, and even if she could, the thought of the dreams make her sick. She needs to get out of here. In the next test, she attempts to breach lockdown of Site 55, but there's no way out. Info Quarantine has the site on lockdown, and the elevator into the site's completely caved in. She's stuck in here with them. The following test, listed as Test Log 5, has the Executive Site Administrator testing Procedure 47 Orun on a group of D-classes. The subjects are familiarized with the procedure, upon which they display extreme distress. Upon attempting to assault an archivist and escape the research chamber, paralysis is induced in three of the D-classes via puncture to the spinal cord in order to ensure compliance. One D-class is terminated via strangulation during preparation of the procedure. Three more are terminated via exsanguination during the procedure, causing catastrophic failure. But three more survive the full procedure. Zero anomalous results are recorded, and testing of Procedure 48 Orun is to begin. In Test Log 3, Morgan notes that they don't even read these, and writes that they just test over and over. There's nothing even left to test. They just continue in the name of testing like a messed up reflection of what was once a Foundation site. There's no life in their eyes. They look like her co-workers, even acting like them sometimes. That's always the worst part. Lucy laughs in that cute way she always did, but now she's describing the best way to vivisect one of them. There's just something missing. The spark is gone, and trying to hold a conversation with them makes her sick. In the next log, she writes that she's losing track of time here. She doesn't know what's in this stuff she has to take to stay herself anymore, but it's heavy stuff. Whatever it is, they can't tell she's here anymore, but there's this fog. Hours she can't account for, and what she can feels like a haze. When she sleeps, she sees what she did when she was one of them. She doesn't sleep anymore. She skips over Test Log 5 and writes that they're looking for her. It must have been Lucy, as she couldn't help it. Seeing her as them makes her want to break down, but she just had to see if anything was left. She followed her for several days, watching as she walked into the bloodline testing wing and carried out acts she heaves at the thought of. She watched for the tiniest sliver of hope until she couldn't bear it anymore. She shouted at her, begged her to remember, herself, her, anything. Just a glimmer of her outside of what they want her to be. There isn't, and now they know she's here. In another Test Log 5, Superior 5th Researcher Lucy Jones administered the mixture to another group of D-class, with one of them self-terminating using research tools. Four of the subjects expired during processing, while another three provided far more valuable data during long-term neurological analysis. Experiment concluded after 45 hours due to lack of viable subjects. Isolation of unenlightened neural pathways now feasible, and infrastructure for identification to be implemented. In Test Log 7, Morgan writes that they're outside, and she's blocked herself in one of their messed up research rooms. This isn't going to buy her long, as she can hear them slamming into the door. It's been days since she slept, and weeks since she's been okay. She's done. She's tired. She hears her outside, begging her to let her in. It's still her voice, but everything inside it is gone. The care, the laugh, everything. It's the most disgusting thing she's ever heard, but she can't even bring herself to care anymore. She's tired. In the last Test Log 5, the subject is listed only as her, and the procedure is insubordination, run by Superior 5th Researcher Lucy Jones. The results read, testing begins. Testing continues. Testing continues. Testing continues. Testing continues. Testing will continue. A muddled image is shown of what looks like someone in pain, with the caption reading, context irrelevant. So, Morgan inadvertently unleashed some sort of infectious infohazard that turns people into monsters. Concocted or at least linked heavily to the Fifthis. Pretty standard stuff for the Foundation, but this one really ran amok and got up to the higher ranks of the site, taking over the whole place. Morgan ended up becoming free of it, but it didn't really matter at that point, as they eventually caught on to her and tracked her down. Now it sounds like she's going to be perpetually tortured for her insubordination. All we know about the infohazard is that it's extremely antithetical to conventional human thought and causes an increased proclivity for violent acts. It's likely connected then to that fifth dimension we read about earlier, possibly giving the entities there a host in baseline reality. Fifthism is pretty purposefully nonsensical and broad and vague, so it can often be hard to define what exactly it is. This was a wide array of SCPs, some only barely hinting at fifthist involvement, and others being full-scale threats of the highest degree. It's definitely a dangerous group of interest, though, obviously wanting to change people and reality to suit their preferred environment, which is a vastly different dimension, and the entities they serve do not get along too well with humans. With the right combination of anomalies and public appeal, fifthism could easily become a global threat and end reality as normal people know it. After all, stars may die in threes, but worlds die in fives.